My name's John Allred, and I am an alcoholic. Congratulations, you guys. A month and 2 months, that's neat. I was reading a while ago. This has been an interesting month. I was reading a long time ago, actually, Admiral Perry's journal. Admiral Perry was an explorer. He was the first civilized man to go to the North Pole. And he kept a journal of all of this stuff, and he was writing that journal. And what he did is, when he was going up there, he would hitch his dogs up, and he would travel. He had a little compass, and he would travel north, going to the North Pole. And then he'd travel for a while, and then he'd pitch his tent, and he'd get out. Night would come, he'd get out his little sextant, this little instrument. He'd look up in the stars and see where he was, chart his course, latitude and longitude. That way he knew how much ground he'd travel that day. And one day he got up and he hitched his dogs up and he headed north, had his little compass out, going north. Worked hard all day long, going north. And at the end of the night he pitched his tent, got out his little sextant, see how much ground he had traveled, and he realized, when he charted where he was, that he was further south than when he started in at the beginning of the day. And it was just bewildering to him because he had lost ground, gone. And he knew he was going north, working hard going north. And the next day he got up and upon research he found out that what had happened, he had moved out onto a big, huge block of ice that was floating south faster than he was going north. And I read that and I thought, hell, that's my story. I can get up in the morning and I can head north, work hard, know I'm going, and lose ground on that thing. And that's the way the last year's been for me, actually. And I wasn't supposed to be that way. I never thought that sobriety was supposed to be that way. Now, nobody told me, one of the great fallacies you'll hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know if I mentioned this or not, one of the biggest fallacies you'll ever hear is somebody will say, well, I'd rather have quality sobriety than quantity. You ever notice people say that and never have any quantity? They've got about 2 years sobriety. I'll tell you, I'm more impressed now with long-term sobriety than when I first got sober. You know, because I know that those guys that have long-term sobriety have lived life on life's terms and not drunk. You know? 1988, October 1988, I was supposed to, I'd been invited to go over to Shreveport to the Tri-State Conference. It was a big conference, about 2,000 people attend that nice conference. And I was going to be the banquet speaker Saturday night. So I got up Friday, got dressed, packed, walked out, passed my pool down to the car, got in my German car. I was going to leisurely drive over Friday to Shreveport to attend that conference in Shreveport. So I'm a big shot. I was take Friday off. My wife couldn't go. She had not a big shot. Didn't work. And she was going to fly over that night. I drove over to Shreveport and my wife came in Friday night and attended that conference. And good speaker Friday night. I was supposed to speak Saturday. Got up Saturday morning. I've got this beautiful picture of successful sobriety, right? And I got up Saturday morning, I just wanted to die. I just wanted to die. I was in so much pain. Made a terrible talk. Just a terrible talk. In fact, I ran into a Catholic priest that speaks quite a bit. He was over there. And I ran into him about 6 months later at another conference. And we were having dinner Friday night. He said, man, you gave a terrible talk in Shreveport. And I said, no. He said, what's wrong with you? I said, well, you'll hear about it tonight. And what happened, I learned something. I learned that it takes me one day to screw my life up and a year to accept it. Because what happened in October of 88 really started in October of 87. And in October of 87, you might remember those of you that are old enough, that's when the stock market had a big crash. And it dropped 500 points on Monday, Black Monday they call it. It dropped 300 points the Friday before that, 270 points Friday before that, and that was a third of the market. In the stock market, which would be like our market today, losing 3,000 points in a day, you know. And I lost a little bit of money in the stock market, not a lot. I didn't have a lot of money in it, but I lost a little bit of money. And if I'd have done what my sponsor did, I'd have been okay. If I'd have called up my phone, picked up the phone and called my sponsor and said, what are you going to do? And done what he did, I'd have been okay. Because the market came back and was ahead of where it was by December. It was ahead of where it was when it dropped in October. But I didn't do that. I sold everything, all the other stock I had, and started to play stock options and proceeded to lose, over the next year, proceeded to lose about 40 times as much money as I lost that one day. And one little problem with that, it wasn't my money. Well, it kind of was. I had borrowed it from the bank. I signed a note. They loaned it to sign a note. And they loaned me all this money, and I lost it. And I was in, and the note was coming due, and I'd lost all that money. And the thing that was making me real sick was nobody knew. Nobody knew. My sponsor didn't know. Nobody I sponsored knew. My wife didn't know. Nobody knew that that I was even in the market doing anything. A ton of secrets. And I got home Friday, I got home Sunday, and called my sponsor up, met with him Monday, and laid everything out with him Monday of what I'd been doing. And he said, well, the only thing I know what to do, man, is work the steps. He said, I hate talking to him like this, because he always starts off by saying, well, I got no magic. And what I want is magic. You know? I want magic. And he says, I got no magic. I just know to work the steps. So he said, you're going to have to write an inventory of the last year. Now, it's not a fourth step. It's an annual inventory. The book talks about annual inventories in the 12 and 12, where we go back over the last year and see what we've been doing for the last year. I don't have to go back to when I was 4 to find out what happened when I was 4 that's making me buy stock options when I'm 30. Okay? That's not what this is. This is just the last year. What secrets have you been building in the last year? What little plans, or little schemes, the book says are little schemes. What little schemes you've been working on the last year? And usually they're secrets, you know, that nobody knows about. And so write that inventory out for the last year. And I wrote that in. It took me one night. I wrote it. Met with him on Tuesday. Took a fifth step with him on Tuesday. Read him that inventory on Tuesday. Then I got to change in 6 days. I got to go make amends. You got to go to the bank. Talk to the bank. And let them know I don't have that money, and the note's coming due, and I'm going to have to make arrangements to pay it out. Because it was a signature note. And I got to make amends to my wife. Because she didn't know about it. And, you know, in Texas, community property, so the nice thing about that is that, you know, half of everything you have is your spouse's. Including half of your debt. And so she thought we were doing fine, but she didn't know about this huge mountain of debt I got over here, you know, and my little scheme that I've been working on. So I told her on Wednesday, I said, I'd like to meet with you on Thursday, make an appointment. She said, you'll make an appointment with me? I said, yeah, I want to make 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock. Pick 8 o'clock because I didn't want her hungry, so I wanted to do it after we'd eaten. And I didn't want her tired, so I wanted to do it before it got too late. And I knew that she would be angry, and I figured I'd be lonely. So we'll do it at 8 o'clock. And so I met her at 8 o'clock on Thursday and laid the whole thing out to her. She cried. She couldn't believe it. She cried a little bit. And I went and talked to the bank, started to make arrangements to pay the bank off, and things would have been fine. It would have taken us a few years to pay that off. A lot of years to pay that off. But one problem. I didn't quit doing it. But the funny thing was is that the next year, 1989, was just the opposite of 1988. Everything I did turned to gold. I made a fortune in 1989. June 10th, what a great day in my life. I made more money on June 10th of 1989 than I'd made in 10 years total. You know? Now, you got a problem when you do that. If you're sneaking around doing stuff like that and it's sneaky, you got a problem. Because you got a problem if you lose because they find out. You got a problem if you win because they find out. Because you got to tell them. I mean, you can't go file your taxes and then they say, how much money did we make? How did you do that? Where'd that come from, you know? So you got to tell them. And I'm not supposed to be doing that stuff. So I waited. She was in Chicago on June 10th. Going to come back on Saturday. So on I cashed everything out and got all my money, and I paid off all of our debt. I mean, I paid off every bill we ever had. House and all. No debt. And I had another chunk of money I put in the bank. And with a deposit slip, and I took all of our paid receipts, and I put them in a manila envelope. And I picked her up on Saturday. She came back from Chicago Saturday. I picked her up at the airport. We went home, and I said, "Honey, can you come into the living room? I have something I'd like to share with you." You know, we went in the living room and sat down, and I handed her the manila envelope, and she opened up and saw all these paid receipts and this big deposit. She said, "What? What happened?" And I said, "Well, honey, Tuesday, God told me to buy." And she cried. She said, "I'm supposed to leave you if you do that." And I said, "I know that. That's why I put a little money in there so you have." They can't leave when you do that. You know, get all this money and things are good, you know. And she's gonna buy a new car, you know, what the hell? And things would have been really perfect then. Except for one little problem. I didn't quit doing it, you know. And by the way, I don't want anybody to think I got a lot of money, because as I said, I didn't quit doing it. I don't know who's got it now. And in August, she divorced me, and we got divorced. And we got divorced like in 61 days. There's a 60-day cooling off period. And she had the attorney lined up, and 61 days after we separated, it was over. And my head was just spinning, man. I couldn't make heads or tails out of this thing, because I had a lot of money. So, and I thought, I went to my sponsor, I said, this doesn't make any sense to me at all, you know? I mean, look at what all this. I said, if these roles were reversed, she thinks I got this compulsive gambling problem. I said, look at all my money here. I said, that'll consider me a financial genius. You know, if those years were reversed, I lost that little bit of money in 87, 88, yeah. But look at all the money I've made this year. I said, if the years were just switched around, they'd be talking about me as being a genius. And he said, "Well," I said, "I don't know whether you've got a problem or not, or what, or it's just causing you problems." He said, "But why don't you go home and see what you can find out? Go home and take a piece of paper out and write down on a piece of paper all the things that investing in stock options has done for you, all the benefits it's provided you. And then on another piece of paper, write down anything it's cost you and see if you can learn anything." So I went home. On one piece of paper, I had one benefit. I'd made a little bit of money at that time. And as I said, I didn't get the key. I don't know where it is now. Made a little bit of money. That was it. Only benefit. But what had it cost me? It cost me my marriage. It cost me my home. It cost me my family. It cost me my job. So how'd it cost you your job? See, this was my schedule. Now, I was, at that time, I thought I'd been. I'd have been 9 years sober, 8 years sober. I could see nothing wrong with this behavior. I could see nothing wrong with it. When I'm 8 years sober, I can see nothing. This was my behavior. This was my schedule. I'd get up every morning at 5 o'clock. Because, see, I got three newspapers I got to read. Got three newspapers I got to read because I'm going to make trades that day. Read my newspapers, do my homework, get to the office at 8:30. I actually get in the office at 8 o'clock because I got three stockbrokers I'm running. I got to call, make my trades. Stock market opens up at 8:30. I start making my trades in effect. By 10 o'clock, I'm like a drunk needs a drink now. I'm pacing the floor at the office. I can't stand it. I got to know what's going on. You know, so I leave the office at 10 o'clock. Only been there an hour and a half. I leave. Office isn't open till 9. I leave at 10. And I'm running. They had to fire me. I'm running the largest sales organization in my company. It's a $22 billion company out of New York. I'm supposed to be training those guys and working with those guys. And I leave. I go home. Because I go home, I turn on the TV. I got to watch that little banner going across the bottom of CNN, FNN, headline news, in case something happens. I don't even know. Talking to my stockbrokers on the phone, making trades. Yeah. Work hard all day long doing that. Wife comes home. She's been working. She comes home. She says, let's go out to dinner. I said, no, honey. I'm tired. Been working all day. I said, let's order out and bring it in. You know, because I can't leave. I can't leave the house. I got to watch CNN, FNN, headline news, watch that little banner go across there in case something happens. Now, the market's not open. but it's going to open up in the morning. And it's really hard to do because I can't watch those channels. She knows if I'm watching those channels, I'm playing the market. I'm not supposed to play the market, so I got to wait. She goes to the bathroom and I hit the remote channel. Finally, she goes to bed at 10 o'clock. I step to 2 o'clock in the morning because now I can watch CNN, FNN, Headline News. I can watch all those channels on there. You know, after the first hour, it's just a repeat, but I'm watching until 2 o'clock in the morning. Finally, I go to bed at 2 o'clock in the morning, get up at 5 o'clock, start my day all over again. I'm 9 years sober. I can see nothing wrong with that behavior. You know, nothing wrong with it. Do you think I ever, at one time in that year that I'm doing that, do you think I ever, one day, picked up the phone and called my sponsor? Not once. Do you think I was of any value to anybody I sponsor during that year? They'd call me on the phone, and I'd say, "You doing okay?" And they'd say, "Well, yeah." "Fine, call me tomorrow. Quick." No value. I'm busy. I'm watching CNN, FNN, Headline News in case something happens, you know. Into that thing. Not once did I ever see. Step 10. This is vital, man. Particularly for long-term sobriety. Because I get myself in more jackpots with step not doing step 10 than anything else. See, step 10 is a repeat of the first 9 steps. It's a fail-safe. See, because step 10 says, continue to take personal inventory and when wrong, promptly admit it. Well, before you can take an inventory, you have to take steps 1, 2, and 3. Then you take your inventory, which is step 4. And then when you get through with your inventory, you got to give it away, which is step 5. And before you even went wrong, promptly admit it. Before you make your amends, you got to take 6 and 7 to change. Talked about that last week. And then you can make your amends in step 9. So step 10 is really a fail-safe step. It's a review of the first 9 steps. And you take step 10. If at any point in time I call my sponsor during that year and said, "Well, let me tell you what my day has been like today," it would have all ended. It would have all stopped right there because he'd have said, "Are you nuts? You're crazy. That's the most bizarre behavior I've ever heard about in my life." Never shared that. Ton of secrets. And we are as sick as our secrets. And when I got those secrets I'm working on, I get sick. And I put my sobriety on the table, and I'm saying, "I'm willing to risk my sobriety for it." You know? Can't risk it today. Got too much time in there to risk that. Never call my sponsor to learn anything. Ton of secrets. I learned a lot in going through that whole process. I learned a lot about pain. I learned a lot about my willingness to rationalize. See, I was rationalizing my behavior that it's okay because look at the money I'm making. You know? Rationalization, the book says, back in the appendix, that rationalization is the process we go through where we make socially unacceptable behavior socially acceptable. Is this not a form of insanity? Straight quote out of the book. And I was making socially unacceptable. And I love to do that. So the simple thing is now, whenever I have to justify my behavior, you ask me something, if I start to justify it, that behavior is wrong. See, my subconscious will build a defense why it's okay for me to do that. You know? If it's wrong, I will build a defense why it's okay for me to go do that. If it's right, I don't. My mind doesn't build a defense. I just do it. And if you say, "Why are you doing that?" Well, but I want to do it. Is there something wrong with it? No, I won't build a defense. But if it's wrong, I will build a defense. So if I start, my sponsor now, whenever I, and anybody I sponsor, whenever I start to justify my behavior, they just ask me one question. "Why do you find it necessary to justify that?" Because if it's right, I don't have to justify it. And I love to justify. I got a good friend. Most alcoholics are that way. We justify our behavior when it's wrong. I got a very good friend. Love Dick. Dick's a little older than me. He's a lot older than me. And at this time, Dick and I got divorced about the same time. And I wasn't married, and he was dating this gal. Every time I'd see Dick, we'd talk. And I'd say, "How you doing, Dick?" He said, "You got to meet my new girlfriend." "Really?" "Yeah. I want to tell you, John, she's beautiful, and she is, without a doubt, the most sensitive, most mature 20-year-old I've ever met in my life. I've learned so much from her. I'll bet you have, Dick. And, you know, John, if she, in the past 8 years, in the past 4 years, she's really only had 3 days drunk. But she's only got 90 days today. But if you add them all together, she's only been, in 4 years, she's only been drunk 3 days. You know? And that counts for something. I understand, Dick. I totally understand it. But I love to justify my behavior. You know? I learn about sponsorship. I learn why you need a sponsor. You know why you need a sponsor? Because you can't see what you're doing. It's like climbing a mountain. You ever climbed a mountain? When you're climbing a mountain, you can't see the mountain you're climbing. You can see mountains around you, but you can't see the mountain you're on. You're on the damn mountain. You can't see it. You're on it. You know? And you can't see what you're doing. Your sponsor, he's not on your mountain. He can see what you're doing. He says, there goes Ulrich. Look at that fool. He's climbing that, going right off that cliff. One more time, going off that cliff. And they're down at the bottom of the cliff waiting to pick you up. See, I couldn't see what... you can't see that. You can't see what you're doing wrong. You know? And even if you can see it, you don't believe it. Because your ego's so whacked out. See, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about... people will always tell you what they're doing. They always will. They'll always tell you who they are. But my mind doesn't believe them. At least not with me. I tell you, I was dating a gal. Very first date I took her on. We went on this date, had a great date. I'm dropping her off at the door. And she says to me, you know, I have a confession. I said, okay, what's your confession? She said, well, I stood a guy up to God for you tonight. You know what my mind said? I don't blame you. And then, 2 years later, when she stands me up, I can't even get mad at her. She told me what she was. See? They always do. It's like that old turtle and scorpion. You know, the turtle and scorpion meet at the creek. And the scorpion says, hey, you going to cross the river? Yeah. He said, can I climb on your back? I'm going over there too. No, you crazy, you're a scorpion. You'll sting me. I'll die. Don't be crazy, man. He said, if I'm on your back and I sting you, you'll drown and I'll drown. That don't make any sense. Turtle says, that's right. So climb on. So gets on to get halfway across the river. Scorpion stings me on top of the head. Turtle says, you crazy? I can't believe you did that. Why did you do that? And the scorpion said, hey, you knew what I was when you picked me up? And I knew what she was when I took her out. My mind would not, she wouldn't do that to me. See how her ego works? Not to me. She wouldn't do that to me. I can't even get mad at them when they do that kind of stuff. Okay? Because they tell you what they are. Business people tell you what they are. And we just have to believe them. They tell you something, believe it. You know? And then don't get involved in it. Stay out of the bushes, you know? You don't need to get in that stuff. I learned an awful lot going through that. I learned about pain going through that divorce. I used to think that sobriety was going to be pain-free. If I get sober and I work these steps, I'm not going to have a lot of pain and trouble in my life. It's going to be pretty clear, smooth. Right, you know? Now, the book never tells us that. In fact, the book warns us just the opposite. The book says, in our adventures, before and after. I mean, you get some adventures after you get sober. You know, and they're probably going to be a hell of a lot more painful than when you got here. At least all mine have been. But learn about pain. See, I get in a wreck If I'm broke up physically, break my leg, I'm in the hospital, you come in. Physical damage is pretty easy to diagnose. And it's pretty easy to tell. It's going to take you 6 weeks to heal that, for the leg to heal. They'll tell you exactly how long it'll take for those bones to mend. So we're going to put you in a cast. Here's what we're going to do. And I'm going to give you some painkiller. Take away the pain. But you know what they do? That's a real art. They could take away all the pain. The doctor could give you painkiller, take away all the pain. They never do that. Never. See, because they don't want you to jump up, forget you got a broken leg, and re-injure it. They want that pain there for a reason. That pain is there for a reason. So you don't re-injure yourself. Spiritual and emotional damage is much harder to diagnose. Impossible to talk about how long it's going to be. And it's very hard to understand how all that plays together. But it's the pain. It's the same thing. See, God could take away all that pain. I'm convinced of it. Never does it. Because he didn't want you re-injuring yourself. If you came, and yet somebody walks in here, guy's just lost his job, his wife's left him, he's had his house repossessed, and he's bankrupt, and he's got 8 years sober, and he walks in and they say, how you doing? Fine. Scared to death, tell people, I'm screwed up, man. I just lost my house. Lost my job, lost my wife. I don't know what I'm going to do. Because he's been sober too long. Been sober 8 or 9 years. You know? And then what happens when we find out about it? And he's crying in the meeting. Say, well, you know what? You need to accept that. Get on with your life. Now, by the way, I'm a big believer in acceptance. I do believe in the old page 449, you know, in the third edition, 449, where acceptance is the solution to all my problems. I believe that. But see, it took me a while to learn what acceptance was. See, acceptance doesn't change the way you feel. It changes the way you act. And the proof of that is your alcoholism. When I accepted my alcoholism, what happened? Did I still have a desire to drink? Yeah, some of us did. But our actions changed. We didn't drink one day at a time. We prayed to have God change us, and then God removed the desire to drink from us. And so our emotions finally caught up to our actions. And that's what's going to happen with all that stuff. So when I accepted the fact that I was getting divorced, still, or you're breaking up with somebody, or whatever, you lost your job, whatever that pain is. Yeah, you accept it, it still hurts. You know? It still hurts a lot. But then your actions can change. Then you can quit, like, you know, doing those location drive-by checks. You know, where you just drive by their place, make sure everybody's home. those telephone calls, you know, where you call and hang up. Well, that caller ID messed up, didn't it? Didn't caller ID just blow that pieces? And quit all that stuff. You know, you accept the fact it may still hurt a lot, but you know, the actions can change and they'll eventually catch up with you. In fact, I was sitting there, it used to hit me in waves. I'd be driving down the road and it hit me in a wave. I'd just start to cry. And I remember pulling up my sponsor's house and I went in there. And I was saying, when am I going to get well? When do I get well? I've done everything you guys have told me to do. When do I get well? And Ruth, my sponsor's wife, she got more time than any of us. Don't like Ruth. She's needle pointing. She puts down her needle point. She looks up and she says, what makes you think you're sick? I said, well, look at me. I'm bawling, man. I can't quit crying. She said, yeah. She says, why does that mean you're sick? I said, well, the book says so. She said, it does? I said, yes. The book says whenever I'm disturbed or upset, there's something wrong with me. Spiritual axiom. She said, yeah, there's something wrong with you. She said, you're mourning. She said, but let me tell you something. If that phone rings, and I pick up the phone, and it's the police saying, your son has just been hit by an automobile and is dead. that's going to hurt. Does that mean I'm sick? Or is that pretty normal? She says, pretty normal to feel that stuff. She said, in fact, the fact that you're feeling all that pain tells me you're not that sick. If you didn't feel that stuff, then I'd be really worried about you. I mean, they have names for people that don't feel that stuff. You know? It's pretty normal to feel that way. And I used to always be thinking that if I'm feeling that stuff, I'm not working the program. It's very normal to feel that pain in sobriety. It's what you do with that that's going to make the difference. You know? And I'm going along there. I'm trying to work my program. And they told me this, that now you need to work with others. You know, one of the best ways to get out of that pain is to get in there and get in the program and work with newcomers, right? So I started going to all these meetings, working with these newcomers. And I'd go to these meetings with, hand out my business card to these newcomers. And every time some guy get a desire chip, I'd go back and give my card, and he'd give me a call. Problem, when you do that, they start to call you. You know? And I only handed it out to men. I didn't hand my card out to newcomer women. Only they wouldn't let me do that. Just men. And I was going to one. And this is true. This was really ego deflation at depth. I'm sitting there and I said, Preston, and walked in a little late, sat down, and looked over, and here's this good looking gal, about, I don't know, 20, 22 year old gal. Just staring at me. Yeah, okay. I'm doing okay here. Whole meeting she stared at me. And I was talking to her friend, and she's looking at me, and I'm doing all right with this, man. So after we said the Lord's Prayer, she made a beeline for me, come right over to me, and introduced herself. And she said, my friend tells me that you're single. And I was at the time. I said, yeah, I'm single. And she said, I would love to introduce you to my mom. I have ego deflation at depth, you know. That's why they only let me pass it out to men. Just men get my card, that's it. And so anyway, I pass it. These guys are calling on the phone, and I start sponsoring all these newcomers, right? So I'm sponsoring these guys, and they're calling on the phone, and they'd say, listen, if you're going to sponsor me, we need to get together because you need to understand some of my core issues. And this was in 89. I didn't know anything about core issues. I said, your core issues? Yes, my core issues. See, I come from a very dysfunctional family. I said, really? A dysfunctional family. Yeah, very dysfunctional family. And because of that, I was broke up and it was just terrible. And I never had any real proper role models. So I have an abandonment issue that I've never really learned to cope with. And because of those role model problems, I didn't have proper role models in my life. I have a problem setting boundaries. Don't know how to set any proper boundaries. Which, by the way, has led to sex addiction. It's just driving me crazy here. I'm listening to that. I'm exhausted. We've only been on the phone 5 minutes. I'm exhausted. I think, we got to get together, I guess. You know? So they come over. They got all these books with them they get from treatment, you know. They bring those books over there. And I don't know anything about this stuff. And they're on their latest, you know, designer drug. And it's helping them. And they bring these books over. I got to get up to date on this new recovery program we've got working here. And I want to tell you, you want to read all that stuff and get into that issue deal, anger management, you want to get into all that? Read those books. Let me tell you what will happen to you when you do that. You'll relate. And I'll tell you why you're going to relate. Because I was in the insurance industry when they did it. What happened is the insurance industry was spending out about $250,000 on drunks that weren't getting sober. You know, they were sending them to those treatment centers and put out $28,000, $30,000 a pop. That's how much it got to. And they would come out and they'd get drunk. Recycle them back in there and they'd get drunk. And they did some studies and they found out that a guy that walks through the door of Alcoholics Anonymous and sits his butt in a meeting, and those that go to treatment and then come into AA have the same percentage of recovery, the same percent succeed. And they said, why are we sending them to treatment and spend all that money when they can just go to AA and have the same shot of recovery? And so they said, what we're going to do is we're going to define alcoholism as a mental disorder. And under the mental disorder clause of the insurance policies, you have $5,000 lifetime benefit. Okay? Well, the recovery center said, $5,000? We can't do that for $5,000. Well, that's what you're going to get for mental disorder. For alcoholism and mental disorders, $5,000 lifetime benefit. He said, well, we're broke. You just broke up the industry. But then some of the recovery centers said, wait a minute. It's a mental disorder, huh? Yeah. We got $5,000 for alcoholism is a mental disorder? Yeah. Okay. How about depression? Can we get $5,000 for depression? Oh, yeah. That's a mental disorder. $5,000 for depression. Okay, now we're up to 10. Okay. How about anxiety disorder? Can we get $5,000 for that anxiety disorder? Yeah, we can do that. Oh, okay, now we're up to 3. How about if they're sex addicts? Oh, yeah, we can get that. Okay. I want to tell you something. It was all created because they couldn't get you well. And so they took all of our character defects and made them mental disorders. That's why you relate to them. They categorized our character defects and made them mental disorders, and now they can get paid on them. And if you don't believe me, I want to tell you something. If you've been in treatment in the last 10 years, and you got out of treatment, I want to promise you something. You had more than one thing wrong with you, didn't you? Nobody comes out of treatment with just one thing wrong with them. Or you'd be in there a very short time. You got to have a lot wrong with you in order to get paid. So they have to diagnose you being all screwed up. You know? That's how it happened. Like it or not, that's the reality of the situation. You know? And so I'm reading all this stuff, and I didn't know any of that. Then I'm just reading this stuff, and I'm getting concerned. And I don't want to tell them not to do that stuff because they're working with doctors, and they got their counselors working with them there, and they got this new designer drug they're taking, and I'm not getting well. They're getting drunk, and I'm not getting any relief at all. And I went to my sponsor, and I said, "Okay, my program is not working. My program's not working." He looked up and he said, "Well, why don't you try ours?" Then he asked me some key questions. He said, "John," he said, "are you? How many guys under a year are you sponsoring?" I said, 14. Under a year. He said, "Any of them getting well?" I said, "No." And I'm getting sick. Yeah. Then he asked me a key question. He said, "Well, John, are you passing on to them the same simple program of Alcoholics Anonymous that was passed on to you?" And I wasn't. And I had to go make amends to those 14 guys, knowing that most of them would leave and go find other sponsors. Because I couldn't do that anymore. You know? And I don't want anybody to leave after I've been here all month to not know the program of AA that was passed on to me. Because that's what I'm responsible for, is to pass on the same program that was passed on to me. And when I sit in a meeting of Alcoholics, I know they don't have them over here at Legacy, but when I sit at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in my home group, and they would get off on those tangents talking about what their therapist has them do for anger management, you know, or how they're learning to set proper boundaries, you know, or these other disorders that they've got that they're working on, you know. Hey, I don't get mad at them. Okay? They don't know any better. I get mad at guys like me that have been in the program long enough to know better, to know that there's no recovery in chasing that rabbit. You're going down a rabbit trail, man, and there's no end to it. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous that was passed on to me doesn't say a damn thing that I have to learn to deal with, control, or handle any of my issues. In fact, it says just the opposite. It says you can't do it. If I could have dealt with my issues, I'd have done it 25 years ago. And you had a different speaker today. The program that I was passed on to me says that you're beyond human power. There's no human power on earth that can help you. You're beyond that, which means you're sick. You are one sick puppy. And you're going to have to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. I don't call my sponsor to learn how to manage my life better. That's not what my sponsor does. I don't go to AA to learn how to manage my life better. AA is not a fire station. You know? We don't come running in here with her hair on fire saying, oh my God, what am I going to do? She's left. She's done this. She's done that. You know, what am I going to do? You know? AA is a program that teaches you not to set the damn fire. You know? After you've gone through the steps, you've cleaned up that stuff, then through step 10, we don't set any more fires. And when we do, they're real small, and we put them out before they get, before your hair catches on fire, you know? My sponsor's not the fire chief. I don't call him to learn how to manage my life. There's a real difference between managing my life and surrendering my life to a power greater than myself. And what we do in here, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. See, the only reason we work the steps is to have that spiritual awakening. That's why we work the steps, is to have that, to find that power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem. Now, that only applies if you believe in God. If you really believe that God personally is going to take care of you. Ah, John, yeah, okay. There's a God. I know there's a God. And he created the world, but, you know, come on. He's not personally going to get involved in my life. I mean, you know, he gave us a brain to think. You know, we got to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. You got to do the work. You know, he's not personally going to take care of me. He's not personally going to get involved in my life. Maybe this whole thing is just a coincidence. You know, the Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson got together and somehow just worked. Yeah, that God was probably involved in that somewhat, but this whole thing is just a coincidence, you know. A lot of this stuff goes on around here. Just a coincidence. It's like I'm sitting in Dallas North, my home group. I'm 2 years sober. All I am at that time. I'm going to Dallas North, my home group. Big group, 200 people in that group. Birthday night, lasts forever. And I'm getting ready to leave birthday night. And before I get out the door, Joanne comes up to me. She's working the front desk. Joanne comes up and she said, listen, this little lady in San Antonio called. And her son's up here in Dallas, and he's going to commit suicide. He called her. He's been drinking for 2 weeks. He called her, and he's going to commit suicide. And she called us. She can't get up here quick enough to stop him. But she called AA, because he'd been to AA, and wanted to know if we'd go out and help her son. And I said, well, I don't want to go by and see him. He's got a gun, you know. But let me call her. So I called her in San Antonio, told her who it was. She started crying. She said, my son called me. He's real disoriented. He's been drinking and drugging. Hadn't been asleep for 2 weeks. Been drinking and taking drugs. And he's real disoriented and he wants help, but he's suicidal. He's going to kill himself. And he had called AA, but he couldn't find AA's phone number because he's so disoriented. But he could remember his mama's phone number. He called his mama and he asked me to call AA. Can you go help my son? He's going to kill himself. And I said, yeah, I'll call him. So I called him on the phone, told him who it was. I said, you want some help? He said, yeah, I need some help. I said, tell me what your address is. I'll come get you. And then he said, I can't tell you how far I am, man. He said, I'm too disoriented to give you directions. And I said, you don't need to give me directions, just give me your address. He said, I live on a little street, it's 2 blocks long. It's a brand new street, not even on Mapsco yet. You'll never find me, I can't tell you how to get here. It's not worth it, I'm going to kill myself. And I said, just give me your goddamn address. Find me. So I gave him his address. He lived on Dome Street. Now for 22 years I've been telling this story. And every time I tell, all over the Metroplex, every month I tell this story to a group in Dallas-Fort Worth area. And every month I say, does anybody know where Dome Street is? That's thousands of drunks in 22 years I've asked if anybody knows where Dome Street is. Nobody knows where Dome Street is. It's a little street, 2 blocks long. But see, I know where Dome Street is. I know right, I have a client that lives on Dome Street. He not only lives on Dome Street, he's literally the next door neighbor, the guy making the phone call. I said, I know right where you are. I'll be there in 5 minutes. I grabbed Tom, a guy I sponsored, we went to make that 12-step call. That's just a coincidence, isn't it? God ain't going to do that. You know the odds of that? The odds of a woman in San Antonio, she calls information in Dallas, directory information, asks for AA in Dallas. We had like 150 groups in Dallas. They, for some reason, the operator picks Dallas North. And for some reason, Joanne, working the front desk, out of 200 people, picks me with 2 years sober to make that 12-step call. And I know where Dome Street is. I'm a gambler, right? Oh, you want to bet on that. That'll work. That'll happen a lot, you know. You know, the odds are, that's just coincidence, isn't it? God ain't going to do that. He's not going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us. Since God works through people, just a coincidence. God ain't going to do that. A few months after, I'm going out to California on a business trip. And I'm at the airport. Plane's going to leave at 9 o'clock. There's a big sign up there saying plane's been delayed. Problems with the plane. No big deal. I get my coffee. I don't have to be there till 1. They come back an hour later and they say, this plane is broke. We can't fix it. We've got to get new equipment. But there's a plane 2 gates down going. We've got some 17 seats on standby. You can go down there and put your name on the list. Well, 100 of us run down there, you know, to that gate, put our name on the standby list. And I'm the second to the last one that let on board. I got on board. So I get on the plane. I go back there. This is when you can smoke on planes. So I go back there. There's one seat left next to the window in the smoking section. A good-looking gal, red dress, sitting in that seat right next to me. I looked and I thought, God is working in my life today. So I sit down. This is a bad seat because she's a chatterbox, man. She's chatterbox. Just chatterbox. I have not had enough coffee for this woman, okay? She's a chatterbox. Finally, the plane takes off. She shuts up. She pulls out a needlepoint. She's needlepointing. I look over and see what she's doing. She's needlepointing the Serenity Prayer. My turn. So I said, what are you doing? And she's real embarrassed. She says, I'm just needlepointing. I said, I know you're needlepointing, but what are you needlepointing? She wants to show me. I finally talk. She holds up. She says, well, they call it the Serenity Prayer. And I said, oh, man, are you one of those Jesus freaks? She says, no. She's needlepointing. She says, but I am trying to live a spiritual life. I said, really? Yeah. I'm watching her now. She knows I'm watching her. She's going real fast. Her hands are sweaty. I said, you really do that fast? She says, I know. I shouldn't do this. I'm real compulsive. I said, no kidding. But I'm watching her. I thought, I'd better stop this poor gal before she breaks the finger. Because she knows I'm watching her. She's blah, blah, blah. So I finally said, honey, wait a minute. If that's the Serenity Prayer and you're trying to live the spiritual life and you got that compulsive attitude, I said, let me ask you a question. Are you a friend of Bill W's? And boy, she put her name point down. She looked at me. She said, yeah. Are you? I said, no. She gets a funny look on her face. And I said, he died years before I got sober. Come to find out, this gal had 2 years sober. This was her first trip away from Dallas in sobriety. She'd never been to California in sobriety, didn't know a soul in California, was scared to death to go out there. She came out there for 2 weeks on a business training, new job she had, training for this new job, and she had her first drunk dream the night before. And she thought that was a premonition she's going to get drunk in California. And she just petrified. And we had a great 3-hour meeting on our way out there. And I cried a little bit, she cried a little bit, told about some of my drunk dreams, and she says to me, she said, I've been trying to quit smoking. Sitting up in the non-smoking section, and when they announced they were going to let some people on from another flight, we could move if we wanted to. I moved back here so I could sit in the smoking section. Can you believe that God would have me move back here to sit by you? I said, yeah, he canceled my whole flight to get me to come over here to sit by you, you know? That's just a coincidence. And God ain't going to do that. He ain't going to do that. That's just a coincidence. He's not going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us, is he? Since God works through people, that's just a coincidence. I'm down in Del Rio, Texas, 1990. A little conference down in Del Rio, Texas. About 70 people attend it all. In fact, I think they've closed it now. But I'm down there in 1990, and I meet this gal Saturday afternoon. Her name is Dottie. She's got Dottie E. from Connecticut written on her badge. I said, Dottie, what are you doing in Texas from Connecticut in Del Rio? She said, well, we're on a live in Connecticut. My husband's in the Navy. He's stationed out of San Diego, and we're on our way to see him. Got the kids, and we spent the night here last night. We were going to go on today, but I thought, you know what? Let's just spend the day in Del Rio. And heard about the conference and NAA, so I came to the conference. I said, well, great. Welcome to Texas. So I spoke Saturday night. I got through speaking. Dottie comes up to me. She says, I heard my story. So she said, so you grew up in Utah? I said, yeah. She said, well, do you have any relatives in Orem, Utah? I said, well, I grew up in Orem, Utah. She said, well, are you related to Mark and Betty Jo? I said, well, they're my parents. And then Dottie starts to cry. She throws her arm around me and she tells me what her last name is. And she says, Bobby's my husband. I said, Bobby's my first cousin. We're the same age. She's 3 days older than me. We grew up together, riffing and running, and then we got out of high school. He joined the Navy. I went to college. I hadn't seen him in 18 years. And Donnie and he met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they got married. They had 6 years sober. And she was on her way to see Bobby to divorce him. I said, Bobby got drunk. He was drunk that night. We called him. He was drunk that night. He had a real God issue. We grew up with the same God, and he had a real God problem. Couldn't reconcile God. And we called him that night, and we made a little 12-step call. I'm here where Bobby is today. And I know that Bobby today has 14 years sober. Yeah. Now, that's just a coincidence. You know the odds of that? She's in Connecticut. He's in San Diego. I'm in Dallas. And we meet in Del Rio. Because she don't want to, she wants to spend the day in Del Rio. No, nobody spends the day in Del Rio. That's just a coincidence, isn't it? God ain't going to do that. God ain't going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us, is he? Since God works through people, that's just a coincidence, isn't it? 5 years ago, I was in Hawaii, the Hawaii State Convention. And I was going to speak out there, and Friday I got a phone call, and my dad had died in Salt Lake. And it was hard getting off the island. All the coming off that island, they just couldn't get off. We got off late Saturday, and had to come a real funny way to get off, because we had to go from Hawaii to back to San Francisco. We had a four-hour layover in San Francisco. Then went from San Francisco back to Dallas, and then from Dallas down to Houston, then from Houston back to Salt Lake. And it took us 24 hours to get there. And we got there Sunday evening, and we buried my dad Monday morning. And Tuesday, I had to come back to Dallas, because I had to go to work. And my son dropped me off at the airport like 2.5 hours ahead of time, because he had to go to work. And so I'm at the airport, and that was really the first time I was alone. And I was tired. Hadn't slept at all much, and I was lonely, and I started into the valley. Started really questioning, what am I doing? You know what? My dad died. I should not have been in Hawaii at that conference. That's just ego. That's just an ego trip from the podium. I should have gone, because my dad had a heart attack about 2 months prior to that. And I called my mom before we left, and she said, yeah, he's doing better. Go ahead and go. No problem. But I should have gone home. I should have gone home to be with my mom when my dad died. The good son would have been home with his dad and his mom. Now, my older brother was there, but I should have been there. I shouldn't have gone to that conference. I should have gone to Salt Lake to be with my dad when he died. I'm right in the middle of beating myself up real bad. And they came over to the intercom, and they said, would a friend of Bill W.'s pick up the white paging phone? I started to laugh. He thinks he needs the 12-step call, you know. So I'm about to pick up the phone. Met this guy from Chicago, met in the coffee shop. He's from Chicago. His dad had died a year prior to that. We had a great little meeting there about that. I asked him, I said, you page a lot of drunks at the airport like that? He said, never done it before. Just want to see if there's any drunks in Salt Lake, you know? That's just a coincidence, isn't it? God ain't going to do that. I'm sure you all have heard a lot of pages for Bill W. at the airport. I never heard of one before. You know? Never heard of one before. That's just coincidence. See, I also learned that what God told me was, hey, my dad was going to die. My brother was there. I couldn't have stopped it. My primary purpose is to help other alcoholics. And the carpenter even said, let the dead bury the dead. You know? Well, my obligation, I was there when I needed to be there. I needed to be there before he died. I'd been there after his heart attack. And I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. That's just a coincidence, isn't it? I meet that guy. He makes a page. God ain't gonna, he's not going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us. Since God works through people. See, I share that story tonight because I know that tonight in this room there are some people in a lot of pain. I'm one of them. Because my life's a wreck right now. Wish I had time to go into that. But I do know one thing today. If that's where you are, then you need to know that I... Sometimes, see, if I happen to sobriety, it's like, you get all this gunk, you know, getting on with life. And sometimes you walk over the edge of the precipice and you're looking into the abyss and you don't know. Does God really love me? Does this God deal really work? I've been sober a long time. Why am I going through this crap? You know? Does that God deal really work? Or is that just a podium rhetoric that we tell each other to make us feel better because we really can't do anything about it? And if that's where you are, then I know today, more than I ever have, that God loves us. He really does. And you're never more than one or two miracles away from being okay. You know? And if that's all you got, that's a cakewalk for God. You need a couple miracles and you're going to be okay. And if you don't know that this God deal works, then borrow my God. Because the God of my understanding today is totally committed to our happiness, to our well-being, and to see that you make it. I used to think that was a one-way street, that we had to be totally committed, willing to go to any lengths to get sober. I know today that God Himself will go to any lengths to see you get this deal. He loves you that much. No question in my mind about it. He didn't bring you here to drop you. Don't understand what's going on. Scared to death. But you know what? I only need one or two miracles and I'm okay. And that's a cakewalk. And I don't know when God's going to help you. But I do know exactly how He'll help you. What He's going to do is He's going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information. Because God works through people. That's why, for Pete's sake, don't isolate it. Stay active and come to the group. Talk about it. When we leave here tonight, we're going to stand up and we're going to say the Lord's Prayer. And in that Lord's Prayer, we're going to say something about, "For thine is the kingdom." I've never known of a kingdom that didn't have a king. And if God is our king, and we are His children, then we are prince and princesses of a king. And as such, if He's the king of the kingdom, and we're prince and princesses, then we have an inheritance. And I'm insisting and demanding on my inheritance, as you should be, because you deserve it, because you are His child. And He don't want to see you hurt. And He doesn't want to see you go through that stuff. And the inheritance is yours. You have to claim it. So all you gotta do is claim it. And you do that by surrender. And it's an incredible deal. We got it all right here as prince and princesses of a king. And I'm humbled to be in your group tonight, because I know who I'm talking to. You guys are incredible. I love you. Thank you very much.